The Diary of a CTO podcast. Sharing the secrets of successful CTOs. Brought to you by Trumor, the home of technology recruitment. Hosted by Guy Bevington.
Cool. So Dan, welcome.
Hi.
Thanks for being here with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
You are most welcome. It's my pleasure, sir. So Dan, you are I think it's fair to say, a very experienced technology leader, over 25 years experience in the industry. Not making you feel old, but it's the truth. I think in our last conversation, we worked out actually, we've probably known each other for like over 10 years on the basis that I think we've been interacting in various companies throughout our times. So it's really nice to finally get the chance to sit down and actually record this with you. So thanks very much for coming. So throughout the years, you've assumed various leadership positions in lots of different companies and most recently founded your own business. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Which is No Nonsense Leadership. So really excited to hear a little bit more about your work and your approach there today. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about you, your background, and ultimately kind of what got you into tech in the first place, and go from there. So if you kindly give us a little bit of a whistle-stop tour of your career to date, that would be fantastic.
Absolutely. So I kind of count myself as incredibly blessed. I'm that generation that grew up with tech. You know, tech came about while I was a child. My parents were very passionate about it. They were absolutely adamant that I was going to have some form of career in tech. I could tell you many stories about how that happened. But I guess most relevant, I started off as a dev. And I thought that's what I wanted to be, genuinely. I was that guy. You know, I'm going to be a developer for my whole life. And I got incredibly lucky. I had the benefit of a CEO who genuinely tapped me on the shoulder one day and said, I'm going to make you into a CTO. And I kind of thought, why? You know, what's that all about? It wasn't part of my life plan. And his argument was, you know, you speak many different languages, and that confused me even more because I have a basic grasp of English. But what he was referring to was that I have an ability to talk to technical people at that level, but also translate that into executive terms.
Yeah.
And everything in between. I didn't see it as a skill or a talent at the time. It was just what I was doing, and it was how I was able to get the job done. So the CEO obviously identified this, and he then wrapped me with coaches, mentors, consultants that could help me on that journey. And so, you know, I rocketed really quickly and then had to slow down and really understand what I'd learned, put it into practice, make it mine, not somebody else's.
Yeah.
And it kind of went from there. I did best part of 15 years in financial services, culminating in a stock market launch, and then jumped ship, I guess, primarily because I wanted to do something where there wasn't quite so much red tape and bureaucracy holding back innovation. I went out into the world of consulting and repeated the process for hundreds of clients. The things that I'd achieved in that sort of big company environment was very repeatable in the sort of SME space and in the scale-up space.
Yeah.
And that kind of took me up to about beginning part of last year. And I think we all know, you know, 2023, the tech market was a bit of a mess.
Say the least, yeah. not my finest year of recruitment.
Well, you seem to have weathered it well, and I think a lot of people did. But certainly what I could see at the time was, for anybody that was in any form of SaaS business or product-based business, it was really hard going.
Mm.
And we were seeing, certainly from where I was at the time, inside a Salesforce partner, we were seeing opportunities sliding out. We were seeing people pulling back and not investing in technology. And I thought, you know what? This isn't my life plan. This isn't what I wanted to do with myself.
Mm.
And so I took stock and I started again. And I hit wholesale refresh. I think walking into the house and speaking to my wife and saying, you know, I might have resigned. It was.
That sounds like the way I break news to my wife as well.
Yeah,
this may or may not have happened. How are you going to say?
Yeah, hypothetically, darling, if I said I'd resigned, how upset would you be on a scale of one to all?
Where does she land?
She's without doubt my strongest advocate,
nice.
My strongest supporter, and the one that keeps me in check. So we sat down and we talked about it, and she's like, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to help companies that are struggling to scale up. That's my sweet spot. That's the bit I really enjoy, is when somebody comes to me and they say, I want to grow this company 100% year on year, my ears prick up."
Mm.
And we start to have all sorts of conversations then about what does that really look like and what do you think might hold you back? What experiences have you had of organisations that have done that? And that's where I born the idea for No Nonsense Leadership was born, was let's cut all of the jargon and the nonsense that you hear consultants talk about and let's get back to actionable advice or execution, somewhere between the two. So that's probably the quickest I've ever done an intro as to what I do and how I got there. I think we've covered 25 years in about 3 minutes.
Good work, very concise. But it got to the point, and I'd like to go back to the draw upon the point I think you made right in the first few seconds there of one of the traits that you've always been proud of is the ability to kind of strip back the, like I say, I guess it's where No Nonsense Leadership came from, correct me if I'm wrong, but the ability to take quite complex concepts and break them down for anybody to understand. I genuinely believe it's one of the most valuable traits for a technology leader in the world that we live in today, when technology is or should be for most businesses the beating heart of the business and everybody will interact with it in some way, shape and form. But obviously lots of stakeholders for more or less a degree understand actually the concepts behind it. So the ability to really take people on that journey and win hearts and minds, and it's such an important part of the role I see. With that in mind, what do you feel are some of the most valuable qualities of a tech leader?
Wow. I'm going to differentiate. I'm not going to talk about skills because that's a completely different conversation. In terms of qualities, the best technical leaders I know recognize that it's not about technology. It never is.
Yeah.
And invariably, I've started so many conversations with technologists with the phrase, so what? Nobody cares. And for a CTO to say that out loud, that's quite unorthodox. But the reason for it is that in every single context, people and processes lead the way. So if you translate that into what does a good technology leader need to have in terms of attributes, you've got to be a leader. It's got to be in your bloodstream to have a passion for people and seeing them succeed in every single walk. So it doesn't matter whether you're talking about engineering teams and scaling them and making them highly productive, or whether you're talking about business teams and giving them things that will help them to achieve their goals. You've got to care about people.
Yeah.
And so from that perspective, that's what got me to where I am now, is the ability to sit with people, hear their pain, and translate that into process opportunity, a technology opportunity, a project opportunity, even a transformation opportunity, so that they get what they need out at the end of it. That's the, without doubt, the number one go-to attribute. If you look at CTOs on the whole today, I think the branding, the job title, if you like, has become incredibly diluted.
Yeah.
I'm of a time where CTO didn't exist. Our aspirations were IT director because that's what was there.
Yeah.
And then this new thing came over from America. Everyone had to have chief in their job title. But what it really was saying was, actually, you are a peer at the boardroom table. And I think if you're going to take that forward, if you're going to demand equality, and I tread really carefully on the topic because it goes all over the place, but if you're going to demand board level equality, then you've got to behave accordingly. Technology really is an entry point. It's your minimum criteria for achieving the role. There are so many other attributes of an executive leader that you need to know. Commercial acumen, you need to know risk management, you need to know the finances of the business and what I would call the operational heartbeat of the business.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to talk up, down and sideways in order to be credible. And that for me is the difference between somebody that understands what a CTO really does versus somebody that does not.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very, like I say, subjective title, isn't it, in the day and age that we live in now. And fluctuates massively depending on the maturity of the business and actually what somebody's going to be doing on a day-to-day basis, right? The CTO of a fledgling AI scale-up could still very well be rolling up their sleeves and cutting code, whereas the CTO of
That's such a great point. And it, to a certain extent, that logic informed my thinking as to why I was bringing this business to market. Is if you think about the natural journey of an organization from startup, when they're pre-seed, you tend to find either the founder or somebody else at that level is actually the CTO, is actually the full stack developer. You know, they're bringing a product to market as quickly as possible so that they can get some form of investment.
Yeah.
And then investors turn up, and the first thing the investor says is, well, you need a CTO. And that's where the conversation starts is, well, we've got one. It's Dave. He's over there. He's neck deep in code. Mm. No, not one of those. We need one that is investor credible, board credible, market credible. And so how are you going to have that conversation? And so a lot of the time with founders, I find myself saying, well, you know, you've got two choices here. Either Dave has to step up and be that, or you're going to have to wrap Dave with somebody that knows what they're doing and try and mentor him into that position. Yeah. Or you've got a very awkward conversation, which is you're not actually the CTO.
Yeah.
And it's in that regard, the CTO in a startup, in a scale-up, in an SME, in an enterprise is completely different.
Yeah.
And so it genuinely amazes me when I see adverts on job boards for generic CTO job description without any further detail. I go, well, how are people applying for that? Mm. Yeah, how could you possibly hit the apply now button on that job? Because what it means to you, it doesn't mean to most other people or some other people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that must be a really interesting part of your role at the moment. Are you focusing on a particular size of business in terms of a particular maturity, I suppose, in terms of where you're scoring? So you mentioned sort of taking companies that want to scale, you know, year on year, but are you finding that's sort of embryonic stage and sort of taking them to that point, or do you feel that it sort of makes sense once they've maybe got to, you know, Series A and then sort of further scale them from there? How do you feel your kind of style of CTO leadership fits within that puzzle?
Generally speaking, my target, the people I look out for, are the people that are recognizing the pain that they're in at the moment. And so if you think about that journey, when somebody first says, well, we're going to scale up, there is no pain because they're not trying. They haven't tried it. They haven't failed. They haven't succeeded. But once they've been trying to scale up for a period of time, maybe 6 months, maybe a year, one of several outcomes is happening. Either they're achieving the scale at the time in the time frame that they want, so they're getting the growth, they're getting the throughput, there are no warning signs, or they're flat not achieving, you know, something's broken, something's fallen apart, or they're not getting there as quickly as they want or at the level that they want. So I look for people that have got that sort of problem scenario already occurring, because they're the ones I can help the most.
Yeah.
In terms of what does that look like, it is very different in different types of organizations. I've met SME organizations that have been static for, you know, 7, 8, 9 years, suddenly have an event where they're either acquired or they get a capital injection and their mandate is to grow. And at that point, they have a problem.
Yeah.
Their stagnated technology or their stagnated teams, their processes don't work. They're not going to achieve their outcomes. By the same virtue, I've seen organizations inside their first year, you know, they bought an MVP to market, it's been incredibly successful, and so now they want to ramp that up, they want to double down on what they've achieved, and they already know, in their heart of hearts, they know that what they achieved was a lucky accident, and if they try and double down on that, something's going to go wrong and they'll undermine their progress. So yeah. I don't look at a particular size or a particular scale, I look at an executive concern and whether it's there or whether it's not.
Makes sense, yeah, it's a very pragmatic way of looking at things. I love one of the things you said a little bit earlier about, you know, very often you go in and you say it's not about tech, you know, and I think that's a really refreshing approach to hear from a CTO in many ways. But how do you go about that process then of aligning technology with the wider business objectives? What's the sort of methodology that you employ to do that?
It's funny, I don't think my methodology differs fundamentally from anything that the Big Four do, because it was the Big Four that probably taught me and informed me because I lived through their processes. You tend to find, and we're probably going to say it 100 times today, people, processes and technology, and it rolls off the tongue that way round because it's always in that order.
Yeah.
The first thing I look for in any organisation that I go into is what condition are the people in? I don't mean are they fit and healthy and can they run a marathon? I mean, are they engaged? Are they receptive of change? Are they excited about the future?
Yeah.
Do they understand the vision of the business and how they're going to get to where they're going to get to? Because if the answer is no to any of those, then that's your first problem to overcome.
Yeah.
The next thing you look at is there a direct correlation between what people are doing and some form of documented process somewhere. Because businesses that want to achieve scale, in the first instance, have to achieve consistency. Because every time things become inconsistent, you burn human capital trying to rectify problems, you burn budget trying to stabilize the situation. So I look to try and make sure that there are some form of processes in place that I can grade on a level of operational maturity. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be level 5 operational mature. You just have to be on the scale and know where you are, because that gives you a place to improve. Now, if those two pieces are in play and they're good, then technology theoretically can support. And that's where I see the most mistakes happen, if you like. I'll give you an example. An organization goes out to market and they buy a well-known CRM product. We won't name them. They might have a cloud, you know. But they buy it and they bring it into their organization. And the very first thing they do before they've done any staff training is they start customizing the living daylights out of this product to make it reflect the badly designed operational processes and the poor operational structures that are in place. And so within 3 or 4 months, that brand new shiny product is actually really just a support framework for a terribly designed operation. And then obviously the executive team bemoan the fact that it's not increasing efficiency, it's not helping them scale, it's costing them a fortune. Oh, and by the way, because of the amount of customization we've done, we're no longer getting the benefits of all the great innovations that the vendors are producing, because we're not relevant in that landscape. And so for me, technology as a final thought is the best way to make sure that you actually use technology in the right way and you get the right outcome, because you've already done the groundwork. You know your operation's stable. You know your people are there. Bring your technology in at that point.
Yeah. I love that. I think that's, again, a very pragmatic way. I'm going to use the word pragmatic, I think, quite a few times today, Dan, about your approach, but it does strike me as thus. But when you go into a business, and what I like about what you said there is you're tackling a pain point. And I suppose at that point, hopefully, you're finding people at a point where they're receptive to your help. But in the same breath, I guess a lot of people, you know, founders of business are very protective over, understandably so, the products and the business and what they've built thus far. And often, even though they've probably requested your help, you know, maybe a little bit reticent to go, well, actually, yeah, that could work in certain companies, but it won't work for us because we did it this way. How do you go about that process of engaging, you know, founders, senior stakeholders in a business as a CTO, and you know, allowing them to hopefully see your way of doing things as the way forward?
Fantastic question. So I'm very, very lucky. When I jumped out of financial services and into consultancy, a lot of my life became about those early discovery sessions with new clients. You're on the boundary of, are you delivery and execution, or are you actually sales? And so I took on a hell of a lot of coaching when I started that. You know, I wanted to learn. I can't operate in an environment where I don't understand the why as to what we do. So I took on coaching to understand sales psychology, buyer cycles, ICPs, and all those great sales-related topics. But what I learned really early doors was, if you can identify the thing that's keeping your stakeholder awake, then you're ahead of the curve straight away. And so I used to joke with teams that I do these health checks and these discoveries that I was fairly sure I knew the answer normally within the first 10 minutes of a 3-hour call, because my warm-up conversation would be, what's keeping you awake at night? And everyone saw it as a small talk. You know, it was akin to talking about the weather. I'd throw it into the conversation. I'd go, so come on, what's keeping you awake at night? And they'd give me the answer and I'd write it down. And in the next 3 hours, we'd be looking for reasons why that was happening.
Yeah.
And at the end of the session, we'd pull back to that and we go, so that thing over here where you said, I'm not convinced we're going to achieve scale because I think that our technology platforms are creaking. Well, actually, you spent 3 hours telling us exactly why they're creaking. So you kind of know the answer yourself. And that is so commonly the case. And I think you can learn that from the consultants method, right? We've all accused consultants of doing it. They go into organizations, they ask 25 questions, they leave. Then they write those up in a different language and they present them back to you and you go, that'll be £1 million, please. And so I don't disagree. I think that's how it actually does work. Executives have always fed me the answer because they already knew it.
Yeah.
It's very rare that I actually have to go, excuse me, I don't think you're on the right track. On the occasions that I have, it's normally been quite something quite prolific. You know, it's been a, have you considered option X? Have you considered that maybe your tech stack is the wrong tech stack? Or have you considered that your resourcing model is so rigid that you can't flex up and down, so you're not going to achieve the right outcomes? But outside of those sort of examples, I would say a high percentage, you know, 75 to 80% of the time, organizations know what the problem is.
Yeah.
They just don't know how to get to the answer.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes they possibly even do know how to get to the answer, but it's getting that external ratification, isn't it? You know, I think when I've consulted with consultants and coaches for my business, you know, very often a lot of the information they're telling me, I know already, but it's just very reaffirming that they're looking at a sanity check, isn't it? A sounding board in many ways.
I've had, this used to happen to me when I was a permanent CTO. This statement used to come up, which is, you don't have external credibility. When I used to question why we would use the Big Four, I go, but they're telling you what I told them. And they go, yeah, but they've got external credibility. And it never made any sense to me as a sort of young career guy. And now I find myself in the same place. I get CTOs phoning me going, can we have a chat about this so that you can put it into your words so that I can play it to my CEO, because then it's your message, not mine, and we've gained credibility in the process. And I go, yeah, that's absolutely fine. I have no issue with that process whatsoever. It makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
And it genuinely does get the right outcome.
Yeah, yeah. I guess there's some basic psychology there, isn't there, at play of often just external
psychology.
Opinion.
Yeah. Psychology is always in there somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Okay, cool. You mentioned a little bit earlier there about, you know, you go to teams and you ask teams the things that are keeping them awake at night. And earlier you talked about people, processes and technology and people being the first part of that puzzle. I totally agree with you. I think, you know, in my 16 years of doing this job, fundamentally companies that are successful, it's very rarely down to the products or the technology. Absolutely, it's you know, that vision of the business. Is everybody bought in? Is everybody engaged? Is everybody on that journey? And is there full transparency there? But in your experience, and I know just from our time of, you know, working together, that you've definitely built some really high performing teams and you know, companies that have got a real reputation in the market for very strong technical prowess. So as a technology leader, what are some of the techniques and approaches that you take to engaging people and building high performance teams?
I'd love to say that I've got a blueprint for that. I don't think I do. I don't think I have a blueprint for creating high performance technology focused teams. I just know what makes teams work. Fundamentally, nobody comes, in my opinion, nobody comes to work on a daily basis to do a rubbish job. Nobody. But there are lots of things that organizations do that disenfranchise employees, teams.
Absolutely.
And so, hot tip number one, don't do those things. It is as basic as that. But if I take the glib statement and put it to one side, when we're dealing with technology teams, these aren't Monday to Friday, 9-to-5ers. These are career professionals that are heavily passionate about what they do. And so what they like to feel is that they are involved in the process. They understand what the company is trying to achieve and how it will achieve it. They understand their position in that equation. And so the worst thing you can do is stand over the top of them as a draconian leader and block any upwards communication. In fact, I promote, advocate, in fact, I encourage my teams to get out there in the business and form those relationships, network like a madman, understand all of the pain points, all of the hopes, dreams, and fears of your internal customers. Because it's only when you do that that you actually get an idea of the tiny little things that you can improve that have a huge fundamental difference out there. And so that would be point one, is get IT out of the basement. And funny enough, I was speaking to a founder the other day, and I joked. I said, so where do you keep your IT team then? Because I couldn't see them in the building. He went, oh, they're three floors down. Why would you do
that? No natural light, obviously.
Oh, don't be silly. It was the throwaway comment. He said, well, we do provide them refreshments. Fantastic. And you've got a high attrition rate, you say. So that's point one, is get them engaged, get them involved. The second one is empower them. If you're going to expect a lot of people, then you've got to give them the autonomy to make decisions for themselves. You've got to give them the empowerment to feel that they're in control of the situation. You've got to do that in a way that it makes it safe for them. So what do I mean by that? I mean, if you're going to ask people to make decisions for themselves, then the last thing you do when those decisions don't go well is fail to back them. And it's not about backing them foolishly. You know, from time to time, bad things happen and people make bad choices. It's about helping them understand that actually there was a moment in time where that decision was made where you could have spotted what was going to happen next, and educating so it doesn't happen again. So back your team, empower them to succeed, don't get in their way, and then challenge them. And so for me, what does that mean? Challenging them means expecting a lot. And there are people that have reported directly to me, a few of them you know very, very well. I do expect a lot of direct reports. I expect them to take ownership of their career. I expect them to take ownership of their development. Mm. And I will back them 100% of the way. But what I'm not going to do is spoon feed their career opportunities and their development opportunities to them. Mm. I'm going to support them when they come to me and say, this is what we want to do and why.
Yeah.
And if I can align that to some form of commercial outcome that's successful on both sides, then fantastic, everybody wins.
Nice.
And I think that those are the basics. There is obviously thousands of things that we see, we spot, or we sense that we change inside organizations to achieve high performance.
Mm.
The biggest observation, the thing that I always wonder why people don't know it. I speak to leaders in lots of different areas and say, what's your attrition rate? Just out of interest, you know, might be having a beer in a pub on a Friday night. I say, what's your attrition rate this year? And if they don't know the answer to that basic question, then I would suggest that they're probably not very close to their team in the first place, and they're not fully aware of what the motivators are or the levels of satisfaction. And at that point, it's very unlikely you're going to achieve that level of high productivity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you said you haven't got a template, but I think there's definitely some, even though you said they're the basics, I think there's some really fundamental truths in there. And
I haven't got one in my pocket, but I could probably sell you one.
There you go. That's a consultant coming out there.
Give me a couple of hours. I'll make you a template that looks like it does that.
If you genuinely did those things, those four concepts that you talked about there, I think you would create a high-performing team, right? And what I really liked about the couple that you mentioned there about empowering people, challenging people, it's very much what I see the modern-day leadership should be of. It's not the draconian do as I, you know, say. It's getting good people to fulfill their potential and allowing them to build themselves up. And that's how I genuinely believe you get the best out of people. They enjoy the job more, the retention's higher because they genuinely feel like they're growing. And also you're as a business getting more out of people because they can feel like they can actually contribute. And
there are certain, we could do an entire podcast just on leadership alone. There are two points that I'd take away from this conversation. The first is the entire leadership landscape has changed for the better, in my opinion. For the organizations that are succeeding and have been succeeding since the pandemic, it's because they've moved away from how much time are you present to how much are you achieving.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
Inside IT, I've been campaigning for that for 25 years because businesses have wanted IT to work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week when it all hits the fan. But at the same time, they want you at your desk Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. And I go, well, the two things don't go hand in glove. It doesn't work like that. So that side of things has absolutely changed the landscape for us.
Yeah.
The other thing, I guess, is a long time ago, I mean, I was a big advocate of DISC profiling and strength finders and all those great frameworks. But the truth is, recognizing that not everybody in your team has an aspiration to be a leader. And I think a lot of organizations benchmark their teams as it's a natural progression. You know, we go junior developer, we go senior developer, we go architect, we go leader. And I go, no, they don't, actually. There's a whole raft of people that are not only are they happy, but they're passionate about the thing that they do today. And they may well be passionate about that for the next 20 years of their career. The worst thing you can do to them is berate them because they're not stepping up in those roles. Especially if they're highly productive there. Because if I'm brutally honest, the disciplines and the skills that you require at that next level of leadership are entirely different to the ones that made you a great engineer, for example. So
totally.
Being totally cognitive about that and not allowing those things to happen by accident will keep your team in balance. It will keep them driving forward for you. And you'll generate a lot of commitment and motivation by recognizing that some do and some don't want to.
Yeah, great point. I heard something a while ago, and I'm going to misquote it now, but the message kind of stuck with me, that in most tech teams, people get promoted to their point of incompetence because it's a natural progression of, you know, you're really good at this, you're really good hands-on being at the job, and actually there by default, you should be the leader of the team. And like I say, if you genuinely ask that question to people and what they really want to be doing in their career, very often it's not the traditional route, you know, and actually they're much happier staying at the level they're at, maybe, of course, changing the skill sets and the projects maybe they're working on in some way, shape and form. But I think it's a really, really powerful point that a lot of, and I don't think it's tech actually, I think it's a fundamental thing. I see similar things in recruitment. Yep. You know, very often people that are very good consultants in their own right, that just enjoy the nature of doing the job, are terrible people managers, you know, and you see it all
they don't want to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
I've a lot of the health checks, and people ask me why I ask the question, I speak to the middle tier of management and I go, is this what you want to be doing? Do you enjoy this? And more often than not, they go, I hate it. I hate managing people.
Yeah.
I hate assigning tasks. I hate being responsible at that level. And if you look at the pattern, I think Adelina Chalmers speaks about it regularly. You can see it from distance. So what happens is someone gets really good at what they do. Somebody else says, well, they're a leader. So they promote them into leadership. That person then feels massively exposed because they've had no formal training, no coaching. They've got no guidance. They woke up on a Monday with a job title that suggests they should be able to do it. So what do? They double down on what made them good in the first place, which was the doing. And in doing so, they completely undermine the team that's behind them.
Yeah.
Because they're micromanaging, if you like. So good developers are becoming engineering leads and then going back and defaulting to engineering stops the engineering team from growing and developing and progressing.
Yeah.
So I think you do have to recognize that point, and you do have to work with people to try and help them understand where they sit.
Yeah.
And I'm absolutely confident that probably in the last 6 months alone, I can think of three separate occasions where people that are in leadership positions have actually stepped down away from those because we've had conversations and they've gone, well, actually, I was happier as an engineer. I enjoyed it. And I go, well, go do that then. Go do the thing you enjoy.
Yeah. I think that point aligns really well with the shift in management in the world that we're living in today. Like you say, I think historically it's been a case of people earn the right to be promoted through meritocracy and their own performance. And like, you're really good at that, so you should therefore by default do this. But I see in the world we live in today, the best managers are people that haven't necessarily earned the right to be managers, but are passionate about doing the job and going down that route because they're more keen to be facilitators rather than, you know, like you say, the sort of traditional draconian sort of managers. So yeah, a really big point. And I think, like I say, that could be a podcast in its own, but some interesting points touched on there. I'm going to throw a stick of dynamite out there and you know, catch it if you dare. But what would you say has been your biggest challenge that you've faced as a CTO or technology leader over the years, and how did you overcome it?
We're going to wind the clock back to when I had less grey hair and I was clean shaven. Around 2012, I was CTO for a large insurance company. The financial services industry was in a bit of a state of turmoil. You had Solvency II, you had Retail Distribution Review, you had EU gender legislation, all hitting financial services at exactly the same time with a fixed deadline. They were non-negotiables. And I had a team of somewhere around 150, covering everything from architecture right the way through to change delivery, business analysis, QA, dev, the whole remit. And I had a full stack portfolio of things that had to be delivered. And we had one of those infamous all-hands meetings where the CEO announced the regulatory changes that were coming over the horizon and the deadlines for them. And I kind of knew in a heartbeat that it was a defining moment. Two choices: deliver that or close doors until it's delivered. So I had a very grown-up conversation with the CEO. I said, yeah, we can do it, but it's going to take quite a lot of trust. We're going to have to stop everything, and we're going to have to focus on this. We're going to have to achieve a level of trust that we can weave in some benefit, because you don't want to have a whole year where just all you achieve is regulatory compliance. That would crucify the business. But more importantly, I'm going to have to ask a team of 150 people pretty much to cancel everything. You know, stop what you're doing, cancel holidays, don't have birthdays. If you've got children due to be born, please postpone. And that's a big ask.
Sounds fair.
Yeah, totally fair. You know, what's the worst that can happen? And so that's kind of how it went. I spoke to my heads of department and explained the situation. I had a huge ask of them. And they had a huge ask of their team. And we were quite straight up. You know, if this isn't you, if you can't commit to this, then put your hand up now and select out. We're fine with that. It makes perfect sense. It's not for everybody. It's going to be hard. We didn't lose anybody. Not anybody out of 150.
Wow.
We delivered all three objectives on the 21st of December. We bought back holiday. We paid for hotels. We paid for taxis to and from work to get people in and out. We had operations running pretty much 24/7. For well over 7 months of the year, but we delivered the right objectives. And the scariest thing was, in doing that, that same team that I will always be incredibly proud of delivered so many cheeky little innovations that nobody expected. You know, they were never part of the big plan, but they managed to get weaved in at no extra cost, because we were in there completely rebuilding platforms from scratch.
Yeah.
That the business came out more innovative, more able to flex with the times, more able to scale up. And I'll never forget that. I genuinely will never forget that moment. I don't think I can top it. So, yeah, hats off to that team.
Fair play. And I think, you know, one of the things you said there, whether it was sort of being humble but a little bit of a throwaway comment, was obviously just, I'm sure the fact there was very little attrition was the way you handled that situation as a leader, right? And I think being really open and honest with people from the get-go, when the proverbial hits the fan, I think people respect it and you earn more loyalty off the back of it. I think if you're trying to slowly drip feed things to people and you know, the landscape slowly shifts, people sort of turn around about 6 months in and go, hang on a minute, what's going on here? I'm doing something fundamentally different to what I was supposed to be doing the other day. But I think sort of tackling it head on often as a leader and giving the bad news, right, and you give people that ultimatum and they choose to stick with you, again, psychologically, I mean, we keep talking about psychology, but I think it's a huge part of this. It kind of builds that loyalty even further. And then people, like you say, they're so engaged where they can come up with those innovations and things you mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. I think 90% of achievement is belief.
Yeah.
And I have two stories, one of which I could tell, but it would take over the entire podcast, so we'll save it. But I grew up with grandparents and parents that, I'm of that age, you know, there's no such word as can't. If I said can't as a child, I promise you my father would have raised his hand. And he did quite regularly on that basis. And so I went out into the world believing that I could, and I still do today. It drives my wife insane. I'm the idiot age 48 that comes up with mad ideas to go and do because nobody's ever told me I can't. If you can create that, if you can take a team of 100 people and create belief in what seems to be impossible, it doesn't have to be tangible. You don't have to go, and this is how. It has to be something very guttural, something that they can get behind. Mm. You'd be amazed what you can get out of teams, what teams will do on your behalf, and what they will achieve as a group. So, yeah, I think that's where that came from. That was my input into it. They grafted. All I did was create them a platform that they could believe in.
Yeah.
And they went and ran with it.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I think belief's a huge part of any success story, isn't it, with anything inside or outside of work. I love that. Okay, let's talk a little bit about, as we close, the future of tech, right? It's obviously you've been in the industry 25 years. I remember when I first started in recruitment 16 years ago, it's a fundamentally different place today from a technology perspective in terms of how that landscape has evolved with the rise of, you know, AI and Gen AI in particular. What is it you are most excited about about the world of tech as we kind of venture forth and sort of what trends are, getting the fire in your belly?
I think, obviously, the last couple of years, if I didn't say AI at some point in this conversation, I may as well just hang up my boots as a technologist of any format. But what I would say is we are currently in AI version one. And what I mean by that is I don't mean that the technology is immature. It is, but that's not the impetus. The impetus is that in version one of any new thing, it's a trend, it's a fad that everybody is chasing because you've got to have it. You know, if I look at the investment market over the last 12 months, if it had the word AI in it anywhere, you were almost a shoo-in to get investment. Yeah. That has to run its cycle. And we have to get to a point where people aren't bolting Gen AI to products that were perfectly good already. Yeah. You know, I don't need GPT in every single product. I need GPT to be put into products where it can make a massive difference to my day-to-day. And if it can't, then what you're really doing is you're selling me a problem that I haven't got. And it actually turns people off of the product in the first place. Yeah. People start to ship away from it. So I think AI version two will be quite exciting. And I'm starting to see the beginning of that now with products that are coming to market with their variation on a theme of AI that genuinely is making a difference. It's starting to re-empower the human side of things to do things that are valuable. And so, you know, I've been involved in creating underwriting engines and algorithms and clever stuff all my career. I've been accused, you know, I remember sitting in boardrooms 15, 20 years ago being told that I was going to be making people redundant because of the things that I was building. And my argument was always the same. If I do my job properly, your job becomes less meh. Mm. That's all it is. And I think AI has the same, I know AI has the same opportunity today if it's deployed for good.
Yeah.
But we've got a long way to go. Yeah. You know, we've got to get past the compliance hurdles. We've got to get past the safety hurdles. We've got to get past where is it getting its training data from and how is it learning and how do we know that that's reliable and secure and we're not buying into something that's going to ultimately cause us pain downstream. Mm. I think there's been a couple of cases, things like AI bots giving refunds that the vendor then has to subscribe to.
Absolutely. I heard one the other day of a guy buying a Chrysler for $1.
Yeah.
Through a chatbot.
Nice bit of prompt engineering on his part. Take my hat off to him.
Is this legally binding? Yes, it is legally binding. Right, there you go. Yeah. Sell it for a dollar.
Absolutely. So I think, do I think that AI is the most exciting thing in the marketplace right now? No. Do I think that the way the SaaS market has gone is the most exciting thing? Not really. It's a cycle. I'm starting to see the beginning of people bringing things back in-house because they've been through the SaaS journey. They've realized that actually, in a certain context, that gets very expensive. And they've got, you know, I had a best part of an hour on a podcast yesterday talking about things like vendor lock-in and the sanctity of data and what happens in that environment. Mm. So I'm genuinely excited about the cycle of things. So it's not about what's new. It's about how we take what we've got and improve it and make it more fit for purpose. So that's the technology side. As an industry, what excites me the most, and I'm going to say this because it plays into what I do day to day, the way in which we resource technology is changing. You know, 6 months ago, if you'd have asked me, I'd say I have to explain the term fractional resourcing 3 times a day. No one gets it. Mm. Was it part-time? Are you a consultant? Are you an interim? What are you doing? And I go, well, you're not a consultant because you are executing, but it's part-time basis. Or it could be a full-time basis if I've got capacity. Now people are starting to understand that. And I'm seeing, you know, fractional CTO, CMO, CFO. I'm seeing lots of fractional roles suddenly coming together. And what it's really doing is it's giving people that couldn't ordinarily afford that level of talent access to a talent pool they didn't know existed in the first place. So organizations are able to achieve so much more. And I think that is genuinely quite exciting. I think you're going to see some real innovative plays coming out of left field from organizations that historically would have sat on the starting line for a very long time.
Yeah.
And they will start to disrupt. They will start to disrupt enterprises that are stoic and locked into their models. Mm. So I think that's where I go.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something we've definitely seen a big rise in popularity for that model. Like I say, for the reasons of the entry point and the barriers to entry for that level of talent becomes all of a sudden just a bit of a no-brainer, you know. So, yeah, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. Cool, Dan, really, really enjoyed the conversation today. I think you've hit on some very, very interesting points indeed. But I like to end every podcast with the same question, which you may know by now. But what would be your favourite piece of advice that you've ever received throughout your career that you would care to pass on to your fellow humankind? What would that be for you?
To my fellow humankind, I can't choose one. And I apologise in advance. I have two statements that stand out to me.
Happy with tea. Let's go with that.
Okay, the first is, you're born with two ears and one mouth. The anticipated usage was hinted. And people are always astounded when I say it, because I like to talk, I do. But when I'm in work mode, my ears are fundamentally more important. So yeah, that's one of them. And I advocate that. If you're going to be a leader, use your ears. The other one, and a guy, a CEO, Steve Groves, you won't mind me naming him and shaming him, he said to me years ago, he said, doesn't it always amaze you that the good news seems to travel a lot quicker than bad news? Do something about that, will you? And it stuck with me my entire career. I mean, I worked with Steve 20-odd years ago. I've not only has it stuck with me personally, but I've advocated it to direct reports. I've said, do not let bad news travel slower than good. If you're excited to get to my desk with a great piece of news, yeah, then get to my desk with the bad news in the same way, because it's that lack of surprise and being forewarned and having time to process and think about it before it's a critical problem is great. That's it. They're my two pieces.
Nice. I love that. Yeah, absolutely. And I think for that latter, I mean, the first one, 100%. But I think for the latter one, it's about fostering that culture where people feel like they can do that, right? And that's a big part of it as well. Because very often people know they probably need to say something but don't, because they've seen past examples of things potentially going wrong. So again, I think that's a large part of how you handle things as a leader. So yeah, I think both fantastic points and a great way to end the pod. So all I'd like to say is thanks again for coming on.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you, an absolute pleasure. And I wish you all the very best with No Nonsense Leadership. I'm sure it'll be a fantastic success. And please do come on again at some point soon and have another chat with us.
Absolutely look forward to it. In the meantime, thank you so much for your time.